Okay, so today, as I said, we're going to take a brief break from our studies of Sefer Daniel. As Rabbi Goldberg announced, I gave a class on Shabbos. Rain in Boca is like a 5-foot snowstorm in the Northeast. People see clouds and they run for their beds. They have no intention of coming out again. It was raining hard. I had 10 people on Shabbos. Those 10 people got what we call schar halicha. They get a reward just for showing up. And for the rest of you, you get the reward of me repeating the class this morning. So obviously it's Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah, everyone. And what I want to discuss today is what essentially has become in many ways the theme song for Hanukkah. I was just at my children's Hanukkah play at school. And it occurred to me, there aren't many, Hanukkah probably out of all the holidays, there's a dearth of popular songs, right? What do we know? Have a Little Dreidel, Sivivon. I mean, there aren't a lot of really significant, right? I mean, now, modern day, there are a lot of songs, starting with Adam Sandler all the way to the Maccabees. But dating back, there are not a tremendous amount of songs. So Ma'osur, in many ways, has become the theme song for Hanukkah. And what I want to do today is to study it a little bit, to understand the words that we say, and more importantly, to really understand the significance behind it, and why it is that I believe it has become the theme song for the holiday of Hanukkah. That's what we're going to do today. To start off, though, we're not going to talk about Ma'osur. We're going to talk about Hanukkah in general. There is an anomaly to Hanukkah which differentiates it from pretty much any other holiday. And that is a dearth of literature that is written about the holiday. Okay? So for example, does the holiday of Purim find its way into the canon of Tanakh? Of course, yes. The Megillas Esther is one of the 24 books of Tanakh. Does the holiday of Pesach find its way into Tanakh? Of course, we have numerous parshios and Sefer Shmos that all deal with the holiday of Pesach. The holiday of Shavuos, right? We even have a book for Shavuos, okay? Hanukkah, while there is written about Hanukkah in the Chashmonaim, in the Book of the Maccabees, etc., none of those works made its way into the canon of Tanakh. And so if you look through the entirety of Tanakh, you will not see a single reference to the holiday of Hanukkah. That, right off the bat, distinguishes itself from any other of the holidays in the Jewish calendar. Number two is you'll notice that while almost every other holiday that we will celebrate throughout the year has virtually an entire Masechta of Shas, virtually an entire tractate of Gemara dedicated to that holiday. So for example, for the holiday of Pesach, we have Psachim. For the holiday of Purim, we have Maseches Megillah. For the holiday of Yom Kippur, we have Maseches Yoma. When it comes to the holiday of Hanukkah, zero. Nada. Not only do you not have a Masechta dealing with the holiday of Hanukkah, you don't even have a lot at all. You have a couple of pages stumped in the beginning of Masechet Shabbos. That is the only mention whatsoever of the holiday of Hanukkah and Shas. Okay? The third anomaly is that while most every other holiday, we have at least basic historical information about it, either historically or Chazal fill in the blanks for us, when it comes to the holiday of Hanukkah, we know very little, and what we do know oftentimes contradicts itself. So for example, do we know a lot historically about the holiday of Pesach? Of course, we know a tremendous amount about it. An entire Seder night is recounting the events. Do we know about the holiday of Purim? So the Megillah gives us a lot of information. The tractate Megillah, Maseches Megillah, gives us a lot of information. Now, sometimes that'll contradict itself historically because we know things now that the rabbis in the time of the Gemara didn't know based on manuscripts, based on archaeological finds, but that's okay. Right? At least we know stuff. We know things about almost every holiday, except for when it comes to Hanukkah. What does Chazal choose to tell us about the holiday of Hanukkah? So again, we know very little. We know that there was a war. How do we know there was a war? We know there was a war because Haneros Halalu tells us there was a war. We don't know a lot of details about that war. You have to look to the Book of Maccabees, you have to look into historical works to find out information about the war. And one of the things we'll see today is that even what we think about Hanukkah is not necessarily as pretty or utopian as the actual story unfolded. Story of Hanukkah, the war surrounding Hanukkah, we now know historically was much messier than we like to pretend it is. Right? When you ask my son, who's in second grade, what was the story of Hanukkah? He'll say, there was a war, Yehuda Maccabee came, they defeated the Greeks, case closed, everyone lived happily ever after. That is not the way that the Hanukkah story took place. The only other thing we really know from Chazal is that there was this jug of oil. It was supposed to last for one day, it lasted multiple days. How do we know that? That's not even from Haneiro Salalu. We know that from the Gemara itself tells us that. But that's basically it. Right? We don't know a tremendous amount, and I would even venture to say that if I had you take a quiz right now about the historical context and the historical background to the holiday of Hanukkah, I don't want to insult anyone. How about this? If I did in the high school, right? If I did in the high school, I would venture to say most of the high school students, seniors in high school after 12 years of Jewish education, would do very poorly on the test. We have a very rudimentary understanding of the history surrounding the holiday of Hanukkah. So point number one is that while the holiday of Hanukkah is obviously important to us, we know very little to it, and it differentiates itself from almost any other holiday in the fact that there is an absence of literature written about it historically. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two, can you pass me a chumash, please? Point number two is even where Chazal find a reference to the holiday of Hanukkah in the Torah, it is distinguishing itself from every other holiday. So, in the 23rd chapter of the book of Vayikra, we go through, or the Torah tells us all of the holidays. It goes through Pesach, Sfiras HaOmer, Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shmini Atzeres, all the holidays you would expect. Then the chapter ends, chapter 23 ends. Chapter 24, almost out of nowhere, begins with a discussion of the menorah. Okay, I'm on page 690. We're not going to look too much inside, but I just want to you'll understand where I'm heading with this. Okay, so you finish with all of the Moadim, you finish with all of the holidays, and then all of a sudden, you begin a discussion of the menorah. And the question is, what is that discussion doing there? Right, we just had a whole conversation about the holidays. All of a sudden, chapter ends, new chapter, we're talking about the menorah. Why are we talking about the menorah? The question is multiplied by the fact that this discussion of the menorah is virtually the exact same discussion of the menorah as we have 690, as we have back in Sefer Shmos. It's basically a verbatim repetition. So one, why is it here? Two, why do I need it? You already told me this in Sefer Shmot. The answer given, Chazal say that this placement of a discussion of the menorah is a reference, is a veiled reference to the holiday of Hanukkah. That while it's obviously not one of the big holidays, it's not Rosh Hashanah, it's not Sukkot, it's not Shavuos, nonetheless, Chazal find a remez. They find a hint to the holiday of Hanukkah by the placement of the menorah near the holidays. Now, if I were writing the Torah, which I didn't, if I were writing the Torah and I wanted a veiled reference to Hanukkah as one or part and parcel of the holidays, I would have shtumped it in chapter 23. There was no need to have chapter 23 as the chapter of the holidays, end chapter 23, begin chapter 24 with a veiled reference to Hanukkah. Why not put the veiled reference of Hanukkah within the context of all of the other holidays? Clearly, there's a break there. Clearly, what the reference point, or the way the Torah orchestrates this, is there to show us that there's, on the one side, right in one corner, are all of the holidays. Separate and distinct is this other holiday that you're going to have at some point in Jewish history called Hanukkah. And it is separate and distinct. It is different. It's fundamentally and categorically different than all of the other holidays. And the question we're going to deal with this morning is why? Why is Hanukkah different? Why do we know less about it historically? Why is there less written about it? Why doesn't it get its own tractate? That's all number one. And number two is, even when it's mentioned, why is it mentioned as a separate and distinct holiday? Clearly, you put this package together, it's showing us that Hanukkah is meant to be different. The question this morning is going to be why. Yeah.
I remember going back when the Mishkan was dedicated and all of the tribes gave their offering and Aaron didn't bring anything. And then he was sad, right? Right.
And Hashem said, don't worry, you'll have it better off later because your descendants are going to have the holiday of Hanukkah.
Right.
Exactly. Okay? So given all of that background, you would then expect our study of Mao Tzor to be what? To be a story about Hanukkah, right? We know nothing about Hanukkah. We know there was a war, that's it. And we know there's a jug of oil, that's it. I'm now writing a theme song about the holiday of Hanukkah. I would expect it to be about Hanukkah. And as we'll see, Mao Tzor, at least peripherally, when you look at it at first glance, has very little to do with the holiday of Hanukkah. So let's jump right in. You have here, and you don't have to worry about the footnotes, but you have here Mao Tzor, and I included footnotes that were written by a rabbi named Rabbi Meir Orlian. I believe he's at Karen B'Yavne, but Rabbi Meir Orlian. And what he did is he put footnotes to Mao Tzor. Now I'll explain why I believe that's significant. What do we know about Mao Tzor? So we know very little. We think it was written in the 13th century. We know that it was written by a person named Mordechai, because if you look at the first letters of each paragraph, it spells out the name Mordechai. It's not really mentioned in Halacha Sefers, in Sifrei Halachot. It's mentioned in Sifrei HaMenhagim. In other words, it became a custom at one point. It's not a law to sing Mao Tzor, but it's a custom to sing Mao Tzor. Sfardim? Any Sfardim in the room? I don't believe Sfardim read it with the same gumption that we read it, right? Sfardim read Tehillim chapter 30, the one that we read, Ashkenazim read in the morning after davening. Sfardim, I believe, read that after candlelighting. I asked Rabbi Shabtai, I said, does Sfardim read Mao Tzor? He said, nowadays a lot more do. I said, why? He said, because they heard all the Ashkenazim sing it, so they want to write it. It's a nice song. You need songs for Hanukkah, so you sing Mao Tzor. What's beautiful about Mao Tzor is that while it was written relatively recent, the 13th century, it is a magnificent poem. Now, it's not a magnificent poem only for the words, but you'll see, just look at the number of the footnotes, right? Almost every other word in Mao Tzor is a direct or indirect reference to either a pasuk in Tanakh or a Gemara in Shas, which makes it magnificent because the author called from a tremendous wisdom. There was no Bar Ilan back then, right? When you knew Tanakh, it meant you knew Tanakh. It was in your head. So, yeah. So, it's a magnificent journey throughout Tanakh, building that together into this magnificent poem. So, let's jump right in. First paragraph, Ma'oz Tzor. Ma'oz Tzor Yeshuati. Who's Ma'oz Tzor? So, again, you only need to look at the first footnote to see that it's a pasuk in Tehillim, when we refer to Hashem as Litzur Ma'oz, God is our strong rock, right? Okay? So Ma'oz Tzor, Yeshuati, my strong rock, you should bring a redemption, Yeshua. Lechana El Shabeach, to you alone, Hashem, it is worth offering praise. Tikon Beit Tvilati, what are we asking God for? So we're asking God to build our, what's the Beit Tvilati? The Beis HaMikdash. How do we know that? So we know that from a very famous pasuk in Yeshayahu. It's famous because we say it during Slichot, we say it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. V'haviotim el har kachi, we ask God to bring us to His holy mountain. V'simachtim b'Beit Tvilati, and that we should rejoice in your house of prayer, which is a reference to the Beis HaMikdash. So we look toward God, we say, God, you should bring us a redemption. We ask Him to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Visham Todah Nizabeah. And there, we will bring a toda. What toda is it referring to? A korban toda, a korban of thanksgiving that God will have delivered us for all the miracles that He will perform. Leis tachin matbeach mitzar hamnabeach. When you basically take, when you steal, when you kill off the slaughterers, in other words, all of our enemies, azeg mor b'shir mizmor. Then we will sing the shir mizmor, Chanukah tamizbeach. The shir mizmor, the song of the Chanukah tamizbeach, which if you look in his footnotes, it says, is a reference to mizmor shir, Chanukah tamizbeach. That's Tehillim Perek Lamed, the 30th chapter of Tehillim, that we read every single morning at the beginning of Pesukei Dezimra, and on Chanukah we read at the conclusion of davening as well. We read it twice. Does this have to do with Chanukah? We're 1/6 of the way through our journey of the theme song of Chanukah. We mentioned the word Chanukah once. No. What is the first paragraph about? It's a yearning. It's a profound prayer. It's a heartfelt prayer for the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, for the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. Does that have anything to do with Chanukah? Well, we don't mention the word Chanukah, but in many ways it has everything to do with Chanukah. Right? What was the joy of Chanukah? So we mentioned two things. We mentioned that the joy of Chanukah was the oil, and we mentioned that the miracle of Chanukah was the war. The war and the oil were means to an end. What was the end? What are we really rejoicing around the story of Chanukah? We're rejoicing that we have the Jewish regained Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel, in particular over the Beis HaMikdash. So hold your place on page number 1 and turn to page number 4. A magnificent article by Rav Yehuda Amital, the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Tzion, passed away a few years ago now. And it's interesting not only for his conclusion, but for the way he sets up his conclusion. Because the way he sets up his conclusion, again, debunks so much of what we know. I'm not checking my phone, I'm raising the temperature. Right? So much of what we know about Chanukah is elementary. So says Rav Amital, an interesting question arises in the wake of this historical episode. What happened next? What happened after the purification and the rededication of the temple and the miracle of the cruse of oil that lasted for 8 days? Right? We don't think about that. Again, if you only learned basic things about Chanukah, so you assume there was a war, Jews won, oil, happily ever after. That is not what happened. Look at Sefer Chashmonaim. Writes, and it was when the nations around about heard that the altar had been rebuilt and that the temple had been rededicated as before, they were incensed, and they conspired to annihilate the descendants of Yaakov who were in their midst, and began putting Jews to death and killing them. And the nations that were in Gilead were gathered against Israel who were on their border to wipe them out, and they fled to the fortress of Datima, and they put about 1,000 men to death there. Right, not the happy ending. Read his next paragraph. The situation both in Eretz Yisrael and outside of the land was very difficult. The war continued. 4 of Matisyahu's sons were killed in battle. It was hard for them to exercise sovereignty. The reason was clear, again, based on the Gemara, that the Chashmonaim inappropriately usurped leadership. Right? We know that leadership can only come from which tribe? The tribe of Judah. The Chashmonaim were not from the tribe of Judah, so they were punished, the Gemara tells us. Okay? Next paragraph after. Already in the days of Judah Maccabee, there were some ugly practices in Eretz Yisrael. Already then, the internecine battles, which ultimately led to the destruction of the temple, were evident. The clear impression arising from the historical facts that are known to us is that Am Yisrael had nothing to be proud of during the period following the victory of the Chashmonaim. On the contrary, the great light that came about through the Chashmonaim, which we mention every year at this time, was only temporary. Hence we must ask, why the great celebration? Right? It's a great question. When you think about it in those terms, it totally changes our understanding of Chanukah on its head. So he suggests the answer is based on a Rambam. Look in the Rambam that he quotes, where he talks about all of the miracles, and then in the second to last line of the Rambam, where I have it bolded, The Rambam adds a line, which we don't have in the Gemara necessarily, or in our Haneiro Salalu. Says the Rambam, and Jewish sovereignty was restored for more than 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple. Says Rav Amital, the Rambam views the great achievement of the Chashmonaim as the very fact that Jewish sovereignty was restored until the time of the destruction. To his view, Chanukah is celebrated not only to commemorate the miracle concerning the oil, but also to commemorate the appointment of a Jewish king and the restoration of Jewish sovereignty for two more centuries. And this despite the fact that the Jewish state that was thus established was extremely limited in its independence, and its leaders were very far removed from Torah. Right? It was an imperfect salvation. Things were far from ideal. Rav Amital, in the continuation of his article, compares that to what? What do you think he's going to compare that to? He compares that to the miracle of 1948. He says, for those of you who think that we shouldn't celebrate an incomplete miracle in 1948 because Israel's not a Torah state and because we don't have full sovereignty, right? He says, look at the story of Chanukah. The story of Chanukah was not an ideal mirror. It was not an ideal redemption. And yet we celebrate it. We celebrate it for what it was, which is restored Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel. He says, that's why we celebrate the modern state of Israel. Coming back to our discussion of Chanukah and the first paragraph of Mao Tzur. First paragraph of Mao Tzur is a discussion of a renewed or a yearning for the Beis HaMikdash. I believe, again, he doesn't write this, but I believe Rav Amital would argue that that is the whole purpose of Chanukah. Right? What we're celebrating on Chanukah is renewed Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel. We don't have that nowadays. We want to get back there. So we look to the story of Chanukah and we start off our conversation saying, Hashem, please bring us back to that point. Please bring us back to the point of where we will have renewed access, the rebuilding of the third Beis HaMikdash. So in many ways, Chanukah is inextricably linked. It is not mutually exclusive from a discussion of a yearning to get back to the Beis HaMikdash. That's probably why we read Tehillim Perek Lamed. We read that chapter of Tehillim. That chapter of the Tehillim is the song of the day for Chanukah. Because again, we're yearning to get back to the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a class over Kabbalah that said that at that time, and just like in Egypt, where 80% of the Jews passed away, unfortunately,
there
was a 20% of the Jews.
Right.
At this time, just like in Egypt, where the 80% of Jews did not leave,
right,
there were a lot of Jews that were very inclined to be Hellenists.
Correct. Right. We have a misnomer about Chanukah.
I have a question,
yeah.
Though, within this, and then you can.
Yeah.
The Hashmonaim were such zealous.
Right.
They were frustrated with the corruption.
I'll try to repeat her question.
They were frustrated with the corruption.
Right.
Of the Holy Temple, what was going on? Do you think that's why they want to maintain?
Also, very nice. Right. So Yocheved's question is that, right? We think of the battle between Jews and Greeks. That was most probably not the battle. The battle was really Jews versus Jews. It was Jews who wanted to zealously preserve Torah, and Jews who believed that we should assimilate, essentially, we should adopt Hellenism, right? So her question is, that maybe that's why, I think this is what your question is, that maybe that's why we start off with a conversation of a yearning for the Beis HaMikdash. Not just for the, right, part of the frustration was that Jews were defiling the sanctity of what the Beis HaMikdash represented through corruption and through other means. So maybe when we begin the first paragraph with let's get back to the Beis HaMikdash, essentially what we're saying is to the authentic Beis HaMikdash, to the Beis HaMikdash where God is proud to be a part of it. Beautiful, exactly. Yeah, 100%. Okay, that's paragraph number one. Paragraph number two, we go back in time to the story of Mitzrayim. Again, we're back on page one. Raos sava nafshi. My nefesh, my soul is satiated, it's with evil. Biyagon kochi kila, my energy has been sapped through grief. Chayai meru, he doesn't have this word, most of them are siddurim do, but chayai meru bikoshi, right, our lives have been filled with bitterness. And if you look in footnote 15, he flips around the word, but it's almost a direct quote from Sefer Shmos. Vayimaru es chayehem, where the Egyptians made our lives bitter. So chaye meiru b'shibud malchus egla, with the servitude to malchus egla. So what's malchus egla? So right. So we'll look at footnote 16. Yirmiyahu refers to Mitzrayim as an egla, as a calf. The pasuk is egla yefei fia Mitzrayim. Egypt is a beautiful calf. Keretz mitzafon bovo. But a slaughterer will come from the north. Who's the slaughterer? Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar. Right? That's Yirmiyahu refers to Egypt, though, as an egla. So b'shibud malchus egla, right? My life was made bitter by the servitude to the malchus egla, which is referring to the Egyptians. Uvia doha gedola, and with your great hand, referring to, right, we say it every morning, vayar Yisrael etayad hagedola. When God redeemed us from Egypt, he did it with a mighty hand. So uvia doha gedola, God, with your mighty hand, hotzi etasugula, you took out the treasured people. Who's that referring to? So again, also a pasuk in Shmos, where Hashem says, V'yisem li segula mikolamim, that we should be the am segula, we should be the treasure nation from the nations of the world. So uviado hagedola, with your strong arm, with your big arm, you took your treasure nation out. Chel paro v'chol zaro, the warriors of Paro and all of his children, and all of his children, Yardu ke'eved bimtsula, they went like stones into the water. Again, footnote 19, pasuk from Az Yashir, Telmot yichasyumu yardu vimsolot kemo aven. They drowned in the ocean like a stone. Paragraph number 2, any reference to Hanukkah? No. We go back to the story of Mitzrayim. However, we are introduced to a pattern that will repeat itself in virtually every other paragraph, which is this notion of crisis followed by redemption. God, we were in a crisis. The Egyptians had enslaved us. You, despite all odds, come along, God, and you redeem us. Go to paragraph number 3. Devir kadsho heviani. God, after Egypt, you took us to, what's Devir? Devir Kadsho. So again, it's a pasuk where the Devir is the Beis HaMikdash. So God, you brought us to Israel, you brought us to the Beis HaMikdash during the time of Yehoshua and David and Shlomo, right? Vigam sham lo shakatati. But there, even there, we didn't have peace. We had no serenity. Uvano geis vihiglani. And a noges came and sent me into galut, and sent me into exile. What's a noges? So if you look in Yeshayahu, footnote 23, noges is referring to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, Bavel comes, right, and sends me into exile. By the way, many of us have been saying this for years. We never knew what the noges. So this is why it's important to know the words also. Right? Uva noges vihiglani, kizarim avadati. Why? Because what did we worship? Zarim is idolatry, right? You punished us, basically. And you brought Nebuchadnezzar, you brought Bavel on us. V'yein ra'al masachti. Yein ra'al, again, footnote 25, is a pasuk in Tehillim, where it talks about, Hishkisanu yain tar'ela. You drink a wine of bewilderment, right, of confusion. So v'yein ra'al masachti, okay, we brought a wine of bewilderment, Kimache avarti, almost to the point where we were on the brink of disappearing. Right? That's how bad the exile was. And right at the point of where we were about to
disappear.
Ketz Bavel, Zeru Bavel, Ketz Shivim Noshati. At that point was the culmination of the exile of Bavel, which coincided with Zerubbabel, right? Zerubbabel, from the story of Ezra and Nehemiah, right? Zerubbabel is one that brought the Jewish people back. L'keit shivim noshati, at the end of 70 years, you redeemed us. What are the end of those 70 years? That's in between Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni. At the conclusion of those 70 years, with Zerubbabel, you brought us back to the land of Israel. So again, same exact pattern. There was crisis, and then you redeemed us. Again, paragraph number 3, still no mention of Hanukkah. Okay? Paragraph number 4. Now we've gone from Mitzrayim, we've gone to Bavel, and now we go to the story of Purim. Kros komas birosh bikesh agagi ben hamedata. Kros komas bikesh. That Agagi ben Hamedata is a reference to who? Haman, right? We know Haman is Haman ben Hamedasa ha-Agagi. So what did he want to do? Kros komas bikesh. He wanted to cut down a specific tree, a kros, right? Kros komas birosh. So what's birosh? So if you look in footnote 30, it's a Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara in Megillah, the Pasuk says, Tachas hanatsutz birosh. Ya'ale birosh. So the Gemara says, Tachas hanatsutz, which means in the place of the natsutz, which the Gemara says, Tachas haman harasha, in the place of the wicked Haman, she'asa atzmo avodozara, who made himself like idolatry, ya'ale birosh. I will rise up, birosh, says the Gemara, birosh is Mordechai. Okay, so now let's go back to Ma'osur. Kros komas birosh. He wanted to cut down this birosh, namely Mordechai. That's what Haman the Agagi wanted to do. V'niyai salo lefachol mokesh, and Haman became a stumbling block, right? He became an impediment in our way. But v'gavaso nishpata, what was his downfall?
His pride.
His arrogance, his pride, his gaiva. Rosh Yamini Nisesa, you raised up the head of the Yamini, referring to
Mordechai
Ish Yamini, right? So Rosh Yamini Nisesa, you rose up, you uplifted the Mordechai. The Oyev Shmo Machisan, what did you do to the enemy? Mechisa, from where do we know that word? Macho Emcha Zecher Amalek. You're supposed to wipe out, eradicate the name of Amalek. So we say you did that. Right? The Oyev Shmo Machisa. You wiped out the name of our enemy. Rov Banav Vikinyanav Ala Eitz Talisa. His children and his possessions you hung on a hanged. You hanged. Thank you. My mom would be very disappointed right now. Right? You hanged on a tree. And again, if you look in footnotes 38 and 39, you see that those are basically direct psukim from a story part. So we're now more than halfway through. And we have no reference to the story of Hanukkah. We've gone through Mitzrayim. We've gone through Bavel. We've gone through Purim. Now, Purim has a significance. Because we know, we're familiar with this idea, that there are correlations or differences between Purim and Hanukkah. And they represent two distinct ways in which our enemies have tried to destroy us. Sometimes our enemies tried to destroy us physically. That was the story of Purim. They tried to physically kill us. Sometimes our enemies tried to destroy us not by physically attacking us, but by assimilation. By getting us to think that we're so much like them that we'll then want to assimilate. Right? This comes up in a pasuk in 2 weeks ago, the parsha 2 weeks ago, where Yaakov is about to meet Esav. He sends the messengers ahead. They come back and they say, we came to, does anyone remember the words? El Achi, El Esav. To your brother, to Esav. And Rashi over there says, sometimes he's like your brother and sometimes he's like Esav. So that's Hanukkah and Purim. Sometimes they're like Esav, our enemies, where we know they want to destroy us and we can be on guard that they want to destroy us. But sometimes they are Achiv. Sometimes they, hey, brother, right? Kumbaya, we should all be together. There's no differences between us. It's a love fest. Let's assimilate. Both are equally dangerous. Okay, that's the story of Hanukkah, showing us the danger in there, right? So Purim and Hanukkah have this almost like yin and yang type relationship, but both are direct threats to the Jewish people. Paragraph number 4.
I just want to say, yeah, that you have the dreidel, which is, I heard, this is spun from the top, which is the neshama that they try to...
Right, they try.
And the grogers
from the bottom. Beautiful, right, sure. Absolutely. Again, there are many themes you can develop with that. Okay, so we have Mitzrayim, Bavel, Hanukkah. Finally, in paragraph number 5, we come to Hanukkah. Okay? Yevanim nikbitsu alai. That the Yevanim gathered against us. Azai bimei chashmanim. Anyone ever wonder why it's chashmanim, not chashmonaim? Anyone ever wonder that? We've been saying it our whole lives. So the answer is footnote 41. It's based on the pasuk of, in Tehillim, where the word chashmanim, and I guess poetically he uses the word. So Yevanim nikbitsu alai, azai bimei chashmanim. The Yevanim gathered against us during the time of the chashmonaim. Ufartzu chomos migdalai. And they breached the walls of our migdal, of our tower. Vitimu kol hashmanim. And they defiled all of our jugs. Uminosar kankanim. And from whatever was left, nasa nesla shoshanim. A miracle was performed for the shoshanim. Why are the Jewish people referred to it as Shoshanim? What's the pasuk? Kishoshanim bein hachochim, like a rose amongst the thorns. So that's the Jewish people. We are the rose amongst the thorns, the nations of the world. So nasa neis la Shoshanim, a miracle is performed for the Shoshanim. B'nei vina yemei shmona kavo shiranim. So the b'nei vina, the children of wisdom. Why are the rabbis referred to as knowledgeable? B'nei vina. So probably because, right, we know that there are two people can look at the same miracle, and one can say, oh, that was cute. And the other can say, oh, wow, that was the hand of Hashem. That was the miracle of Hashem. So b'nei vina takes a certain wisdom, takes someone with a certain set of eyes to see something and to recognize the Yad Hashem, and to recognize that this was a miracle of Hashem. So b'nei vina, only those who were willing to see the hand of Hashem, yemeshmona kavu b'shirunanim, they established a holiday. They said, ah, God performed a miracle for us, we're now going to celebrate a holiday for it. Okay, I want to make two observations about this paragraph. One historical and one philosophical. Let's start with the historical. So if you turn to page 5 of your source packets, I want to point the following out. Okay. We have the first word of this paragraph, Yevanim nikbitsu alai, that the Greeks gathered up against us. You will notice that historically, the word was not always Yevanim. So look in source number 3 in your packets. It's from a Siddur Hegyon Lev, which was published in 1845. What are the words instead of Yevanim nikbitsu alai? Yehirim, which means... What's yuhara? It's a gemara. It's a line that comes up in Gemara. It's arrogance, right? So yehirim nikbitsu alai. The arrogant ones rose up, gathered against us. Turn the page. That same siddur, when it comes to haneros halalu. I'm sorry. Alanisim, sorry. Right. So we have b'mei matisyahu ben Yochanan, source number 4. Ben Yochanan kohei gadol chashmonai uvanav. Kishamda Malchus Antiochus. What's the line in our Siddur? Yavan. So two times in one Siddur, the word Yavan is censored out for a different word. A different publication, source number 5, published in 1904. Again, you see the words Yehirim Nikbitsu Alai. Why is the word Yavanim censored out for the word Yehirim? So I saw on this wonderful blog on the main line, quoting from the Jewish Encyclopedia, that the reason why the word Yevanim couldn't be used anymore at a certain point in history was because Yevanim became synonymous with our enemies. Okay? Yevanim became synonymous, most likely because what else has the word Greek in it other than the Greeks? Right? The Greek Catholic Church. Okay? So Yevanim became synonymous with those who were persecuting us. So they had to censor out the word Yevanim for the word Yehirim. I'll show you one more example, and then we'll read the English. But look in source number 6. This is from an account of a massacre on the second day of Pesach in 1655. Now, it's very hard to read, but I will read just a little bit for you. Okay? Look in the first line. But, and again, he's recounting, it's very descript. Ba'u alehem b'medina, b'mirma uvichzavim, right? They came upon us with trickery. V'nishlechu alehem, not sure exactly what that next word is. Hayivanim, they sent upon us something, hayivanim, okay? V'tarfu osam v'kzeivim. And those Yevanim, now we're not talking about Greeks at that point. We're talking about these vicious enemies. What did they do to us? They tore us apart like wolves. Okay? Hariga hitchila be something biyom sheni shel Pesach. The murdering began on the second day of Pesach. Be Medina's Poland, in Poland. Uvechol glilotam, and all the surrounding. And there was everyone was sad. There was massive sadness, persecution, oppression. Everyone was screaming, young, old, widows, orphans. Right when they realized that God had decreed that this vicious wolf would be upon us. Madonna Olam Shalakach Meitanu Agaonim Akdoshim. He took from us all these righteous rabbis. Again, very descriptive. But what I wanted to show to you is that instead of saying, what was the word for enemies? I'll give you an example. Nowadays, when someone is a terrible person, what do you say they're acting like? You say, that person's like a Nazi. That person's acting like a Nazi. Right? That word, for better or worse, has become synonymous with evil. So in the 16th, 17th, right, in the time of the pogroms, what was the word synonymous with evil? Yevanim. So look at what this blog wrote. Yevanim was a particular, this is from the Jewish Encyclopedia. Yevanim was a particularly loaded term in Russia because Jews called the non-Jews Yevanim. They did so because many Ukrainians were of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. It is for this reason that that Hanover called his account of the Chmelnytsky massacres, Yevan Mitsula, and refers to the Cossacks as Yevanim. But we can see it from other sources too. For example, see attached, which is to the right, for a horrifying account of a massacre on the second day of Pesach, 1655. Mm-hmm. So I just want, again, that's a historically interesting note, to know that at certain points in history, the word Yevanim was censored out. Now turn back to page number 5, source number 2. We read in this paragraph, Ufartsu Chomos Migdalai, that they breached the walls of my tower. What is that referring to? What is that referring to? So we assume that it is referring to the walls of the Beis HaMikdash. That is not what it is referring to. Okay? It is not referring to. Look on footnote number 42. I don't want to confuse people. Stay on page 5. So, source number 2, second paragraph. He's going to quote a Mishnah in Maseches Midos. The Mishnah says, V'isa b'Maseches Midos, it's brought in Masechet Midot, Lifnim Mimenu, when it's described in the Beis HaMikdash, Soreg Gavoa Asara Tfachim, V'Shlosh Esrei Pirtzos Hayusham Sheparzu Malche Yavan Chazru Vigadru Vigazru Kenegdam Shloshes Rehishtachavio. Says the Mishnah that there was a Soreg. A Soreg is a fence. That there was a fence that was in the Beis HaMikdash that was 10 Tvachim high. How high is 10 Tvachim? No. Probably around 3 feet. So it is a 3-foot high fence, that there were 13 breaches in that fence that were caused by the Yevanim. So we have a fence that's probably the height of this table. The Yevanim made 13 breaches in that fence. And the rabbis decreed that when you walk by those breaches, you had to bow down to those breaches. Now I ask you, right? We now have one paragraph in all of Mao Tzur designated for Hanukkah. And in that one paragraph, we say, you know what the worst thing the Greeks did to us? Was that they made a breach in this 3-foot high fence. Does that strike anyone as bizarre?
No. Yes.
Of course. So what do you have to figure out? What was the purpose of this 3-foot high fence? Why did it exist? It was not, clearly not there for protection purposes, because no fence 3 feet high is going to protect you. So what was the purpose of this fence? And why were the Yavanim, why were the Greeks so determined to breach it? So continue on. Fourth line of that paragraph. Per Shusham, the Bartanura, Ravadia mi Bartanura, Kishemagia Kineged, Ko Pirzo Pirza Mishtachave, Umoda, Al Avdan Malchus Yava. That when you bow down, you also had to say, thank God Hashem that you got rid of the Greeks. That's what you had to say. So obviously, there's something about this fence. V'inyan hasorig mevur b'tosos yantiv. The Tosos Yantiv, a commentary on the Mishnayos, explains that the purpose for this fence was shenivna kedei laseis makom v'hevdel bein ovdei kochavim hanichnasim lispalo b'beis Hashem uvein Yisrael. Was the Beis HaMikdash a place of prayer solely for the Jewish people? No. If you remember from the Pasuk in Yeshayahu, Va'aviosim el har kadshi, v'simachtim beis tavila si, olaseim v'zivcheim v'artzonim v'zivchi, ki beisi beis tvila yikarei l'chol ha'amim. The Beis HaMikdash was a... Everyone was invited. So if everyone was invited, what was it? A chillin' pot? It was a melting pot? It was the American experiment? What was the Beis HaMikdash? So explains the Tosfos Yontif that no, there were demarcations. There were points where the Jews can go, and there were points where the non-Jews came to daven. What separated that place? This 3-foot fence. That was the way of separating the Jews from the non-Jews in the Beis HaMikdash. Why were the Greeks so offended by that? What was their whole philosophy? They wanted everyone to be together. So what is the most offensive thing if you want people to be together? A fence that separates them. So the Greeks come along, they weren't interested in destroying the Beis HaMikdash. They weren't even interested in destroying the fence. They just made breaches in the fence so that people can pass between the Jewish side and the non-Jewish side. What did Chazal decree when they regained access to the Beis HaMikdash? That when you pass that breach, you have to bow down, right? And you have to acknowledge Hashem saying, thank you for saving us for the Greeks. In other words, I acknowledge that it's okay for Jews to be separate. I acknowledge that built into the Beis HaMikdash is a separation between the Jews and the non-Jews. That's what the Tosfos Yontif explains. So now, none of you understood this, but now when you read tonight, Ufartzu chomos migdalai, you're going to say the Greeks tried to break down the barriers, that which separated us from them. Vitimu kol ashmanim, right? The real celebration is that we highlight our Jewish roots. We highlight what makes us uniquely Jewish. That's the Ufartzu Chomos Migdalai. That is the crisis. Right? Again, everything is crisis that leads to the redemption. That is our one paragraph about Hanukkah. The sixth paragraph, if you go back now to page
three.
Back to page 3. So the sixth paragraph was likely added after the rest of Mao Zedong. Okay? I'm not exactly sure when. I think I looked in the Art School Siddur. It says like 15th century. Not sure. But it definitely was added after. In the sixth paragraph, in many ways, bookend the first paragraph. In the sense that it is a yearning for the ultimate redemption. Chasof Zeroa Kadshecha. God, stretch out. Bear your holy hand. V'kariv ketz ha-Yeshua, and the time for your redemption has come. Nikom nikmas dam avadecha. God, exact vengeance. Exact revenge against our enemies. Me'uma harasha, from the wicked nation. Ki archa lanu ha-Yeshua, because, right, it's been so long that we've been waiting for a Yeshua. But while we have waited so long, what has been unending? There's been no end to the evil, to the persecutions, to the pogroms, to the holocaust, right? Deche Admon. Push off the Admon. Who's the Admon referring to? Who's right? Esav is referred to as Vayitzei Arishon Admoni. In rabbinic literature, when we talk about the four exiles, Edom refers to Christianity. So, Dechei Admon, push off those who are oppressing us. But Sail Tzalmon, under the shadow of Tzalmon. What's that referring to? No, Tzalmon. So again, if you look in footnote 55, the Gemara in Bracho says, Al Tikri Bitzalmon, Ella Bitzalmaves. Tzalmaves refers to hell, death, right? Gehenim. So right? Dechei Admon, push our oppressors. In this case, it was the Christians. Bitzal Tzalmon into the pits of hell. Hakim lanu ro'im shiva, and in their place established the ro'im shiva, is referring to the seven shepherds. The pasuk in Micha, which talks about the seven shepherds, right? David, right? Yosef, all the seven shepherds of the Jews. Okay, now, right? So again, we've started with a yearning for the Beis Hamikdash, and we end very much as a yearning for the Beis Hamikdash. Two comments about this last paragraph. Number one is, because it was added on later, others have said, why shouldn't we add on paragraphs subsequent to that? So if you look in page number 7 of your source sheets, I quoted here from the Kitzer Shla, where the Shla HaKadosh adds on his own paragraph. We're not going to read that inside, but you have it there for you. You also have in source number 8, a subsequent paragraph added on by Dr. Avi Schmidman, Rabbi Yitzchak at Shalom, where they wrote, wait a second, if we're writing about all of the crisis and redemptions throughout Jewish history, what do we contemporary modern Jews have to add on? The Holocaust and the modern state of Israel. So they got together and they wrote this paragraph. You have the Hebrew there, you have the English there, and I included the Biur, which means where they culled these lines from. They tried to follow in the footsteps of the author of Mao Sur. And you'll see that almost every word or phrase in their paragraph comes, we don't do this in America, in Israel, they have special haftorahs for Yom HaTzmaut. So they take from those haftorahs talking about redemption, and they use that to build an additional paragraph that they argue you should say in Mao Sur. In other words, as you've clearly seen by this point, Mao Sur is a journey through Jewish history. A journey through Jewish history is never complete. We've lived at the end of that next phase of Jewish history. And so they wrote a paragraph detailing that. You have that there for you. That's point number one. Point number two, again, it's on pages 8 and 9. I'm not going to deal with it. You can read inside. Is should you be saying Chasov Zero at all? Right? Should we, modern Jews with modern sensitivities, should we censor out Chasov Zeroa? Why should we censor it out? Nikom nikmas dam avdecha, calling for revenge against our enemies. That's not very politically correct. So you have a debate I found between an Orthodox rabbi and a Reform rabbi about whether or not we should be saying this nowadays, or whether we should be politically correct and censor some parts out of it. That is a journey through Mao Sur. Okay? Clearly, Mao Sur is not only about Hanukkah. Clearly, it's a journey through history. And so we come back to our original question. Our original question was, why is this the theme song about Hanukkah? Hanukkah is different than every other holiday. There's very little we know historically about it. Not much is written about it. Here we have a theme song about it, and the same theme plays itself out. Even the theme song about Hanukkah is not about Hanukkah. So why is that the case? That's our trillion-dollar question. So if you turn to page number 10, I want to read briefly from an article from Rabbi Moshe Targ, a beautiful article, and then I want to read for you from a Hebrew source as well, which drives home the point. Okay? Clearly, Mao Sur puts Hanukkah into the perspective and context of Jewish history. And what it's showing us is that Jewish history is never an isolated incident, and we're constantly adding chapters on. Okay? And that's why we focus less on the historical details of Hanukkah. Right? That's not the point. The point of Hanukkah is Jewish history. So look here. If you look in paragraph number 2, where you see that there's a few words that are in total caps. The word after. So that sentence. Says Rabbi Taragin, listing Chanukah after the conclusion of the laws of the Moadim, right, we asked that as our beginning question as well, is a metaphoric method of highlighting its very different experiential function, as well as its very different moment in history. After the Moadim conclude, and after the redemptive history that the Moadim underscore ceases, the events of Chanukah occur, and the reference to Chanukah through the description of the menorah is made. God delays the inauguration of the Mishkan from Kislev to Nisan to ensure that the induction of redemption would occur within the first month of redemption. That's the month of Nisan. So what happens to Kislev? He reminds Kislev that it will play a pivotal role in Jewish history. Not in redemptive history, but in our survival as a nation. As exile begins to loom, a final miracle had to occur to energize the nation and lend it the confidence to survive the harsh road ahead. One might claim that the miracle of Chanukah was the last stop on the road to exile, the final moment in which God performed a national miracle reminiscent of its glory days. Kislev is eminently suited for this dedication of Galut in its unique history. Located at the commencement of winter, it launches the winter of Jewish history and the desperate commitment that was demanded. Each stage of Jewish history is unveiled by a dedication of the Mikdash. The redemptive period commences during the month of Nisan, while the diaspora era begins in Kislev. Chanukah, therefore, is almost like an amorphous holiday. Chanukah is not about one specific time period. Chanukah is about launching Jewish history into a cold and dark exile. And so therefore, Chanukah and the story of Chanukah and the messages of Chanukah are not relegated to one specific time. Chanukah has recreated itself, has reappeared countless times throughout the past 2,000 years of Jewish history. The story of Chanukah has reappeared in our day and age with the Holocaust and the State of Israel. The story of Chanukah occurred countless times, right? The Jews were thrown out of Spain. You end up with a major Jewish revival in the city of Tzvat with the Kabbalists. Every time that there's been a crisis, there's been a redemption. That narrative of Chanukah is not relegated to one moment in Jewish history. It plays itself out time and time again. If you turn in with this, we'll conclude to page number 11, Rabbi Chaim Friedlander. Rabbi Chaim Friedlander in his Sefer Sifsei Chaim writes, I'll just read to you one line. If you look at the first section, the last paragraph of the first section, he writes, "Nimsa she'anhagas Hashem v'nisav shayu b'Chanukah." What Chanukah represents and the way God interacts with His people—that notion of crisis and redemption—einam nisim shaya be'avar bilvad. These are not miracles that only happened in the past, and that's why the history surrounding Chanukah is not what was important to Chazal. Chazal didn't care when Chanukah happened, how Chanukah, that wasn't important. That's important by Pesach, that's important by Chanukah, by Purim. Because those are holidays that commemorate historical events. Chanukah is not remembering a historical event. Ela shebechanukah hem itchilu. Chanukah is the beginning of what? Of exile. Umeaz sheyiru anhaga zo, hivin yiseh ha'ovim v'nimsayim imanu b'meshach ha'galu be'avar be'oveh. While all other holidays are primarily commemorating events of the past, Chanukah is a holiday of the present. And because it's a holiday of the present, Chazal undermine or don't talk about the history behind it. Because the point of Chanukah that they want us to understand, it's not about what happened in the past. It's about what is happening in the present. That narrative of there's a crisis in Jewish history and God has redeemed us is the narrative that we're supposed to remember during Chanukah. That is a narrative that, yes, played out during the time of Chanukah, but has played out continuously during Jewish history. And we believe the light that Chanukah gives us, the confidence that Chanukah gives us, is that we believe it is continuing to play itself out in our day and age, hopefully concluding with the final redemption, with the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash.